Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Law of Code podcast. My guest today is Primavera Di Felipe, a director of research at the National Center of Scientific Research in Paris, faculty associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University, and visiting fellow at the Robert Schuman Center for Advanced Studies at the European University Institute. Primavera, thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure.
I thought we could start with your Genesis block, that is your first introduction to crypto. And I'd love to hear what your initial thoughts were about the technology. Were you skeptical? Were you intrigued? Could you share that story?
So my research has always been on the legal and governance implications of decentralized network infrastructure. So I've been looking at like peer-to-peer file sharing, Tor, mesh networking, and so forth. And so as Bitcoin came about, then obviously I was very interested in looking at this new decentralized infrastructure. But of course, the legal challenge, which is essentially what do we do when all of a sudden we have like a new currency that is not controlled by a bank, but also like the governance around it and so forth. And then it's especially with the advent of Ethereum that I essentially decided to abandon every other stream of research and just focus 100% on blockchain technologies. This is when I moved into Harvard in order to actually carry on this research. And since then, I'm still there. I didn't manage to move away from this because, in fact, as years go on, you know, new challenges emerge, but also new opportunities emerge. And I think that we are still in a phase in which there is so many legal and governance questions around those technology that I have not yet found the point of boredom in this track.
Very understandable, and I can imagine it may still be a few years before that bottom is reached. It seems like every year there's a new innovation, but there's also new questions that come up with regards to how governance can work and even just the legality and the illegality around the blockchain systems. And we'll speak about that in a moment, but I want to go back to your PhD thesis, which I believe became the book Copyright Law in the Digital Environment. And in that, you talk about how the self-regulating features of the copyright regime have been jeopardized with the advent of the internet and digital technologies. And for many listening today, that's not a novel concept, but I can imagine at the time in 2012, that was being spoken about much less often than it is today, particularly given the rise of things like NFTs. And so I'd love to hear your summary on what that paper was about and how that has related to blockchain.
It's very interesting because I unfortunately started and finished my thesis before the advent of NFTs. But the topic of my research was precisely in a world in which there is no longer scarcity because the digital medium is incompatible with scarcity, then how can intellectual property and copyright in particular operate, right? And the core of my thesis was actually the concept of the copy and the fact that the digital world lacks something that can be akin to a digital copy. And therefore, all those private ordering tools, digital rights management system and so forth, they are all moving away from the copy and entering into the realm of copyright and creating new types of protection or constraints that go beyond what copyright was originally intended to protect. And then, funnily enough, then NFT came about and pretty much brought the solution to the question that I was raising in my thesis.
And so when you saw something like a non-fungible token start to gain popularity, did it evolve in the way you'd expected, given the research that you've done?
Well, I think it is providing the core feature of providing a concept of a copy of a unique and authentic digital item. The one thing that, but you know, we're still on the early days, so things can evolve in the coming years, of course. But the one thing that I'm kind of waiting for, is I think right now there is imbrication between the NFT and the legal rights that are associated with it. Like right now, this is still a copyright license on the artwork as an abstract entity, and the NFT is basically just this copy, and we have not yet explored the use of the NFT as a licensing mechanism that provides specific rights on the holder of the NFT independently of the general license that applies to the work as a whole. With some group of lawyers and researchers, we have developed the token bound license, which is specifically trying to create a closer link between the rights associated with the work and the rights associated with the holder of the NFT and what they can do with this copy. But yeah, I think it's a matter of time. I think it takes some time already for the world to get acquainted with the notion of a digital copy, and then I'm sure there will be some interesting legal evolutions as we move forward.
And when it comes to token bound NFT licenses that can be used and can follow the NFT when it's sent from owner to owner and potentially even wallet to wallet, were there and are there outstanding legal concerns, things maybe around privity of contract or others that you think will continue to be issues or are issues when it comes to the implementation of this form of copyright governance?
Yeah, so the main challenge with traditional ways of dealing with this is that you usually create like a personal contract between the copyright holder and the owner of the, like the recipient of the license, which becomes a problem because if I transfer my token, then either it becomes some kind of sub-licensing scheme, but that sub-license is only valid if you still have the license that you can sub-license, or it re-requires some kind of contractual agreement, like a new contractual agreement needs to be created, which creates a lot of legal complexity. The way we solved it, I think, is like an extremely elegant mechanism. It's not using the personal contracting with the privity of contract issue, but rather public licenses like the GPL, like the Creative Commons. So we created a conditional public license. So the license applies to the world at large, and then there is no question of privity of contract, there is no question of sub-licensing or transferring the rights because they apply to everyone. But the condition to be able to exercise the right granted by the license is that you currently hold the NFT associated with that particular license. And so all of a sudden, all those legal issues are actually cancelled because the public nature of the license is such that as soon as the token is transferred, someone else will be recipient of the license with the right to exercise the right. Like everyone is the recipient of the license, but not everyone has the right to exercise the right until they acquire the token.
Because it's a unilateral license grant and not a contract. And so you don't need assent from one party for it to become effective. And I think items like this and how we're tying in the law with code is the future. And speaking of the future, I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts on the copyright regime at a very high level. If you were to be in charge of the copyright regime across the world, what would you look to do to make sure that this regime can fit in the future and be adaptable to the technology while also still affording some incentive mechanism for creators?
Yeah, so I'm also an artist, so I am myself concerned by those questions. As an artist, everything I've done is always using a Creative Commons license because I think that, especially in the digital world, if the artwork cannot be communicated, there is very little value that the artwork can have. I will say that today the real challenge is attribution and traceability, meaning that because it is very easy to copy, it is also very easy to lose track of who is the origin, what is an authentic copy, what is a non-authentic copy. So I think NFTs are solving at least two problems, which are two important problems that also relate to a lot of the Creative Commons artists, which is one is providing proper attribution and really being able to know, is this copy that I have purchased, if I want to purchase something, is it original or not? And then all of a sudden, it's fantastic because today, if you think about like as a digital artist, up until the advent of NFTs, digital artists only could monetize their work by licensing the copyright, which is very different from physical artists. As a physical artist, I sell a painting, I keep all the copyright. If I sell a sculpture, etc., like it's actually quite rare that the artist has to sell the copyright in the work rather than just the work. And so NFTs are actually opening up this new opportunity for digital artists to maintain their copyright, to preserve the ability to protect their rights, while also monetizing, and this time they are monetizing the copy. And the people that purchase the copy, they don't purchase it because they want to have the right to access. The people that buy a painting, it's not because they want to see it, it's because they want to have it, they want to hold it, they want to sell it later, right? So there is this very important distinction that exists in the art world, which is the copyright in the work and the actual item, which is the oftentimes the monetizing thing. And so NFTs are enabling, and it's not just for digital artists, it's also for all those artists that never had the opportunity of selling those items, which is like musicians, which is performers, yeah, right? Poets or whatever. Like there is so many artists that could not, the art world did not play that game around the existing of a scarcity item that can be sold for like millions of dollars. And all of a sudden, all those artists, including digital artists, now can engage with the item. And all of a sudden, the need to leverage copyright as a monetization scheme becomes much less important. And so it actually makes sense to some extent to engage into more Creative Commons-like types of licensing scheme because it maximizes the visibility.
I agree. And I think that is, in one sense, that is the optimistic outlook where now all of a sudden this democratizes access to platforms to sell and to monetize art in ways that never were before possible in a win-win situation where not only are the artists benefiting, but the potential purchasers and those interested in supporting the artists or investing in their works now have an ability to do so in a way that's much more accessible for everyone. In the same vein, there is also that negative component where, well, now all of a sudden anyone can copy, say, the work that you do, mint an NFT and try to pass it off on their own. And I think that's where a lot of the work that is done today is looking at, well, how do we remedy situations like that where there may still be some enforcement mechanism needed? And when you think about that from it, where do you see the role of the state coming in?
I mean, I think it goes both ways. The state is the law enforcer, so you need some entity that will enforce the law. At the same time, ideally, you manage to create a system in which it becomes harder to violate the law. I think in the case of NFTs, I will say like, and it's a matter of, it's the technology provides a solution, but of course it's a matter of being sufficiently acquainted with this technology, but it's much harder to forge an NFT than it is to forge pretty much anything else, right? Yeah. So of course someone can take my work and create an NFT, but that NFT will not be stemming from my address. And of course the problem today is that people are not, I guess, acquainted or educated into looking at the originating address of the NFT in order to know whether it is original. But this is technologically, that's a very safe mechanism of provability. It's more of a matter of like either online platforms or whatnot to demonstrate that. And then, yes, I can still create all the fakes that I want, but those fakes have literally no value. It's obviously a fake, which means that, sure, you can still sue me, but in some way, like if there is no markets for my fakes, then it's less relevant, right? So I think the state is of course required when there is like frauds and scams.
Right. That's interesting. I'm not surprised to hear you say that, given the article that you published in February of not even last year, I guess that's a year before now. Wow, time's going by fast. Back in 2022, why Hermes probably can't stop the Metaberg. And I'll link that in the show notes below, but I'm wondering your thoughts on that case now, if that's changed over time. because in the article you wrote that it, from a precedent perspective, it's dangerous to say that these tokens will need to be destroyed because they're linking to someone, linking to something, as opposed to actually reproducing. And I thought that distinction is really under-discussed in this industry.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there is the very, very big question of, like, what is an NFT, right? An NFT, and it depends, right? Because there is increasingly now NFTs that are incorporating content that are, like, all on-chain. So those are arguably potentially producing a work. But the majority of NFTs are just a link towards a particular centralized or decentralized platform where the content is being held. And it's very dangerous, I think, from like a legal perspective to claim that linking towards something is a violation of copyright because otherwise the internet is dead since everything is linking to stuff that is potentially copyrighted. So there is this challenge. And that doesn't mean that if I create an NFT that is linking to something and I sell it as if I was the author of that thing, then I'm obviously engaging in fraudulent behavior. And so we can use like commercial law or other bodies of law in order to bring a tort against me. But that wouldn't qualify as copyright infringement. So it's more about to which extent can we leverage and to which extent shall we further expand the scope of copyright to also cover a mere reference to something, or shall we instead recognize those NFTs for what they are and therefore identify what existing bodies of law are there that can help us bring a claim against people that are trying to, it's not even forgery because it's not forgery, but trying to sell something as if it was something else. And this is much more into like the trademark or commercial frauds.
It's interesting, right? Because now all of a sudden, if you can't go after the NFT because it's merely linking to another page, well then, next step, you have to go to that actual page and where it's hosted. And so then the charge or the claim would be, well, they're reproducing my artwork, let's just say, hosting it on this website, and then linking the NFT to monetize it. That's a much different legal conversation than linking the NFT itself and referencing something. Is that something you've explored?
Yeah, I mean, it's not that different from all the copyright infringement that is happening every day on the internet, right? So you have like notice and takedown. Like, nothing is new in that sense. There is content and there is ISPs and there is some, do they qualify as content editors, in which case they can be liable for posting content that is infringing? Are they just like intermediaries, and in which case there is the notice and takedown? So like, we are already kind of figured this out. You know, we have like intermediary liability regime and so forth. So that's, NFT doesn't add anything new to this. They are just adding a new monetization technique by linking to existing content, right? And of course, it's challenging because all of a sudden you have like IPFS and then you have like a decentralized network of nodes, and who is the intermediary that could be liable if at all? So there is new legal challenges, mostly because of the decentralized architecture of some hosting infrastructures. But the NFT, I think, is not adding, the NFT itself is not adding much complexity beyond identifying that if someone is selling an NFT and that person is not the copyright holder of the associated content, that probably qualifies as unjust enrichment.
Right. And there was a conversation that you had with Lawrence Lessig at the Blockchain Gov event in Italy about code is law. And you both spoke about the evolution of the internet and how often this phrase is misunderstood in crypto. And I was wondering if you could give your perspective on the idea that code is law, where you think it makes sense and where you disagree with the term.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there is agreeing or disagreeing with the term, because the term is just a term that can be interpreted in many ways. The original way in which Lawrence Lessig envisioned it was that indeed people are increasingly relying on technology, on code, in order to do things that usually we would have relied on law. But that also means that if the law can regulate the code, meaning if the law can regulate the operator, the online operators that are building this technology, then the law has a lot of power as well, still, to regulate the users of those platforms. So code is law is not saying law has no power anymore. It's just saying code becomes a new tool of regulation, like regulation by code. And then whoever controls the code then also have a lot of control over the behavior of people onto those platforms. But that doesn't mean at all that the law has no role to play. In fact, I will say that today, while most of the online operators are using code as a way of regulating those platforms, they are also subject to some extent, some actors more than others, to the law of the jurisdiction in which they are. What I brought in the book, in Blockchain and the Law, and this expression of like the rule of code, is using a different expression to express something slightly different, which is code is law is, I think, generally accepted and understood. But code is law doesn't mean that code escapes the law. It means that code can be instrumentalized by whoever controls it. With the idea of the rule of code, the idea is to create this kind of analogy between the rule of law versus the rule by law, where the rule of law is this state in which the sovereign itself is subject to the law that has been enacted, right? Like no one is above the law. The law applies equally to everyone. And there are specific rules in order to change the law that applies to everyone, including the sovereigns. As opposed to those more like, I guess, often authoritarian countries that operate by this rule by law, which is where the law becomes a tool of political power in order to fulfill its own vested interest. And so if we use this distinction and this analogy back into the internet, the majority of internet platforms today, they are ruled by code, meaning that there is the sovereign, which is the operators, that can instrumentalize the code in order to fulfill their own interest, which is usually profit maximization. When we move into the blockchain technology, we enter into a model that is closer to the rule of code and therefore closer to the rule of law analogy, because once this system, of course, there is always the actor that are developing and deploying the system, but once it has been deployed, then it applies equally to everyone and no one can instrumentalize these tools in any different way than everyone else, right? So this is interesting because all of a sudden we can see how different codes have different properties and relate differently with regulation, because of course, because the rule of code is not subject to any sovereign, it also means that even if the law can regulate the operators, the operator cannot change the code. And so all of a sudden it becomes harder to regulate, but it's also the principle have already been embedded, right? So it both has like pros and cons depending on where we stand, but the rule by code, so the centralized platforms, they need regulation because they are at the mercy of the control of the online operators, which have their own interest. Our rule of code platform is not at the mercy of anyone. It's at the mercy of the network, if anyone. But also, it is harder to manipulate and to interfere and to stop from like a regulatory perspective.
Answers like that are the reason why I started this podcast, Primavera. Thank you for that. And I think it's such an interesting topic. And you laid out so many very profound ways of thinking about the difference and the dynamics between how various code is implemented. And the last thing you said, which I just want to double click on and maybe hear you unpack a little bit more, is this idea of where all of a sudden it may be very difficult to change or enforce particular regulation on the code in manners when the code cannot be changed and cannot be altered. But what you can do is you can change the outcomes, much like in the legal system today, where you have some sort of equitable distribution of assets, for example. Do you see that being the role for governments going forward in areas such as DeFi, where when certain things happen, you can't just undo the transaction like you would when there is an intermediary? Because so much of our legal system today is based on having that intermediary.
Right. Yeah. So we lost the intermediary and we lost at least the default of reversibility, meaning that once something has been done, it has been done, and that's where the guarantees come about. And therefore, these require thinking beyond that, right? And this is why I will say that today, as systems get more sophisticated, but also as it becomes more clear that there are sometimes mistakes, sometimes it's not even a mistake, but sometimes there are just like disputes. And many of those disputes cannot be dealt with only with code-based predeterministic rules. There is increased desire and experimentation with, you know, blockchain-based dispute resolutions, with like oracles, with like relying on those external, but still blockchain-based, but additional layers that can be embedded within a smart contract in order to facilitate the resolution of disputes, in order to remediate if there is something that went wrong. But this all needs to be premeditated, right? So if you know that you're engaging into something that might require some kind of reversibility, then you need to put collaterals, you need to create a dispute resolution system. So all those things need to be embedded into the system beforehand, because if you did not, then you're out of luck. Unlikely, not impossible. We've seen in the past it is sometimes possible to revert, to alter the state of the blockchain, but this is obviously highly exceptional and it should remain like that.
I think one interesting trade-off that has happened with this lack of reversibility in certain circumstances is from a consumer protection standpoint. So much of today's world, at least, we take for granted the reversibility, whether it's a bank transaction, whether it's ordering a package online that you know the return policy will at least be generous enough to allow you to return, obviously barring certain circumstances. We've become so accustomed to this idea of I can do something and then undo it within 24 hours. I can call my credit card company, et cetera, to make that happen. And now we move into an era where not only in some circumstances is that not possible, but that also might not be communicated as explicitly to you as it is in certain cases, like a no return policy when a final sale is on. Do you see principles from consumer protection being brought in to really help ensure that consumers are on the same playing field? Or do you think there will be a almost sandbox-like approach where you are taking your own risk by going into this particular area?
No, I mean, I think that eventually, like, it's just a matter of, like, to which extent do we move away from a purely decentralized system, right? So DeFi, I think, is an interesting example. To which extent do people, users, would rather trust a completely decentralized infrastructure or an intermediated infrastructure? And it's really a choice, because so it depends who people trust less or more, depending. Meaning yeah. That some people might rather take the risk of engaging with like a fully decentralized, blockchain-based, non-reversible system because they don't trust the intermediary that might be corrupted, that might, you know, fail or whatever. Others, and perhaps the majority, we don't know, but others might have a counterparty risk, which will be the intermediary, in order not to have to incur all the risk of decentralization. Right. So in the end, it's providing an additional choice. Consumer protection obviously will play a role. It's easier for consumer protection to play a role in the intermediated system because it's harder to identify who are you going against in a fully disintermediated system. But I think the market is also the one that will dictate this, and to the extent in which DeFi is full of scams and bugs, then a lot of people would choose the counterparty risk over the decentralization risk. If DeFi managed to evolve and actually provide enough safeguards and guarantees and whatever, certification and reputation, whatnot. Like, if the decentralized system actually managed to fulfill enough protection without the need of consumer protection, then perhaps people will rather engage with this, with the decentralization risk, than with the counterparty risk.
Is all this good? Are we moving in the right direction with these systems? My personal thoughts are that I'm typically a techno-optimist, and I think that all these tools we create will find a way to use them for humanity's best interest, and I am optimistic about that. But what are your thoughts, Primavera? Is this a good thing that we're moving towards this perhaps more decentralized future, perhaps less intermediated system?
I wouldn't put a moral value on it. I don't think it's like good or bad. I think it's good that there is more choices, that people that want to be more self-reliant, they can do so. I think that's important. I don't think necessarily this is like something that everyone needs to go towards. I think it's perfectly fine if people don't want to like be in charge of all their funds and whatnot, and they will rather rely on an intermediary because, you know, comfort or safety, whatnot. So I don't think there is something good or bad with intermediation or disintermediation, but I think there is something inherently good in creating more plurality and providing a wider variety of choices for people to pick from.
Yeah, that's a great way to think about it too. Even with, there were some complaints by people regarding the Bitcoin ETF, but at the end of the day, consumers now just have the choice whether to invest through an ETF. They're not forced to by anyone. And there is, of course, the chance that people are induced based on marketing and things, but ultimately people do have the choice. I want to talk about the legal side of crypto with you for a moment. And just back in 2018, right, you published the book with Aaron on the blockchains and the law. If you were to go back and update any particular chapter or any particular topic from that book in a way that either it turned out different than you're thinking at the time or has just evolved or new things have come about, does any one particular topic stand out as something that has really changed in the past 5-6 years?
I have to say that actually something I'm actually quite surprised of is that this book is not yet obsolete, meaning that I will say that a lot of the questions that we have raised in the book still apply, of course, with more pragmatic answers today than back then, but the legal questions are still open, and that's surprising. I don't know if it's a good or bad thing, but it's an interesting observation. If I were to like, I wouldn't go back to it because I think it at that time that's what needed to be put out. If I had to put like a new edition of it, I think I will focus more deeply because I think what we need now, like as like legal scholar and whatnot, is really like focusing on bridging, as opposed to like the book was more like looking at how the interplay between the blockchain and the law and how it can like one can take over the other or which one can take supremacy over the other. I think today I'm more interested in trying to like build bridges because I think that the one thing that is missing for blockchain technologies like smart contract, DAOs, to really reach mainstream adoption is we need to eliminate legal uncertainty and bridging between those walls. Like it's fun. Like in order for people to actually leverage DAOs and smart contracts, it needs to be possible to contractualize with existing legal entities. It needs to be able for a DAO to be able to rent offices, pay salaries, and all these things that today are still highly complex. So yeah, I think I would love to like revamp the book by taking the same chapter, the same topics, but really focusing on the how can we create more bridges and how can we create the more like how can we facilitate the interactions between the blockchain world and the legal world.
there is a big gap in that bridging mechanism with on-chain code is law type of an environment, but there is that understanding by many of those people that there is a law outside that as well. And so that would be a very interesting chapter. When you think of that, are there any other thoughts you had on the idea of bridging and like what can be done there, or where would you research?
So I'm currently looking a lot on all this question of like legal personality and legal capacity for non-incorporated DAOs and the extent to which the law is providing specific entities like corporations and whatnot with legal capacity in order to enable them to act in the world. The interesting thing with like DAOs and smart contracts more generally is that they already have technical and to some extent economic agency. And so they don't really need the legal capacity because they already can transact, at least within this technological framework. And somehow they are not recognized as such as an actual entity. And so all of a sudden it creates a lot of potential liability to the users, and it's unclear who is liable for what. And there needs to be some kind of protection for the people engaging into an organization where obviously they only have a small say, and yet the organization can do collective action and so forth. So I think it's really important because the current ways in which we are trying to approach this with like legal wrapper and all those things are kind of weird in the sense that now we have like a technical entity with its own technological and economic agency, and then we create an additional legal entity. But the two are not necessarily linked. It's like a facade of claiming, okay, we now have this legal entity that will act as an avatar for this technological entity, but they are not the same. And the only way to actually eliminate this facade is for the law to actually recognize that those things that exist in the technological framework also have some kind of legal capacity, giving them some legal capacity. And what I think is very interesting is, because it is very hard today to enforce a particular technological design, because a regulator doesn't have a say on how a particular decentralized infrastructure is designed, we need to start adopting this more incentive-based approach, which is, well, of course, no one can tell anyone how a DAO will be built. However, we as regulator, we can tell what are the necessary design features that will guarantee that whatever you're building will be recognized legally as a legal entity and therefore will provide some protection to the members and so forth. And so now all of a sudden, I have an incentive to comply with those, to voluntarily comply to those prescribed technological design requirements because I want to benefit from legal personality, limited liability, and so forth, as opposed to expecting that people will just build it in the way in which regulator wants, otherwise we're gonna shut them down because you cannot shut them down. And so eventually you can choose, do you want to create a standard company? And then you will have to fulfill the standard formalities and all the requirements for regulatory compliance, or do you choose to create like to incorporate specific technological guarantees within this structure, which means that therefore you can fulfill the regulatory compliance in different means, right? And of course, this has some benefits, but this has some costs because those technological guarantees are also acting against you because you cannot abuse them either, right? And all of a sudden it becomes interesting because then it becomes some form of collaboration between the actors that are designing and deploying those DAOs or those smart contracts and the regulator that can see that there are also benefits to that. But of course, the benefits exist and will be provided only according to the compliance with specific technological design as opposed to legal formalities.
You do see infrastructure providers, for example, working with governments and lobbyists, and they have different means. There's systems now that exist for that work, but that those do look much different than what you're alluding to there. One thing I want to talk to you about before we go is the blockchains-based Life Forms Project. I thought that was pretty interesting. And I'd love if you could just describe it, and I'll put a link for people who are interested in checking it out.
Yeah. So this is my little artistic activities, which are inherently connected actually with my legal research. And the idea was, like, back then when I created like the first Plantoid, which was the first blockchain-based life form, was to try and illustrate through artistic means, but also to bring into life. And it was back in 2014. So it was at a time in which, like, as a lawyer, and when I was describing all those potential challenges and like decentralized autonomous organizations, it was not clear to many lawyers, what am I talking about? And so creating an actual, I guess physical, because they are also physical, but like creating an actual entity that is demonstrating the use and the functionalities of a DAO through an artistic practice, actually all of a sudden brings these things that at the time sounded more like science fiction into reality. And then it becomes really interesting, because then I will talk to lawyers and I will explain them the project. And then all of a sudden they will actually ask the right question, which is, well, but what does that mean when you have, like, you know, a Plantoid that receives cryptocurrencies, but then who owns those cryptocurrencies? Because the Plantoid obviously doesn't have a legal personality. And then what happened when a Plantoid is using those funds in order to hire an artist to create a new replica of itself? Is there an actual legal contract? And who can enforce this contract? And who are the parties of the contract if the Plantoid doesn't have legal capacity, etc.? So the idea was initially even as a desire of illustrating the legal research through the instantiation of an actual thing that raised as many legal questions as possible. And then it has evolved into this more like artistic practice of actually creating these new forms of life that are not at all organic life, that are not trying to simulate existing life, but that nonetheless share some of the properties of what we consider to be life, which is the autonomy, meaning that because they operate on the blockchain, they are not under the control of any single actor. The self-sufficiency, because they can collect cryptocurrencies in order to sustain themselves over time. And then, like every other life form, they need to be able to evolve and reproduce themselves. And so again, creating and embedding into the design of those technological systems a capacity, an evolutionary capacity of reproduction by using, in the same way as like we have plants, and plants will leverage bees and butterflies in order to help them in the pollination process. In this case, those blockchain-based life forms, they are using humans, and they are tapping into the greed of humans by collecting cryptocurrency from them, giving them in exchange a digital seed, which takes the form of an NFT. And then as this digital seed is sold and is disseminated on the market, then there is always the 10% royalty that goes back to feed the Plantoids. The Plantoid can actually benefit. The more people speculate on the digital seeds, then the more it will benefit the Plantoid as well. So it creates this kind of symbiotic relationship between the human pollinators and the actual Plantoids, up to the point in which the Plantoid has accumulated enough money, enough funds, and then it becomes like a standard DAO. It opens a call for proposal, and then anyone, like artists and designers and whatnot, can submit propositions about how they envision to create the new version of a Plantoid. And then all the people that are currently holding the NFTs, all the holder of the digital seeds, they can vote on the proposition that they like the most. And then automatically the Plantoid will transfer the cryptocurrency that it has collected in the smart contract to the selected winner, who is then quote-unquote hired by the Plantoid to create a new copy of itself. And again, the legal question remains. I am deeply hopeful that at some point someone will breach that contract just so that finally we can actually try and resolve these legal questions. But yeah, the idea is really like to, you know, for me, like those blockchain-based life forms are essentially, I think DAOs are some form of blockchain-based life forms, and a lot of those algorithmical entities that live on the blockchain are blockchain-based life forms, but the artistic practice enable you to dig further into the various properties that something needs to have in order to potentially qualify as synthetic life.
That is fascinating. And earlier you mentioned that, you know, you've been in the space for quite some years, and that's due to the questions. And just based on your explanation there, I think you may be in this field for quite a few more years, given yes. all the questions that will emerge.
Yeah, I don't think I'm out of it anytime soon.
Would love to hear what you're most interested about or what's most fascinating for you around the legal side of blockchains at this moment. And it sounds like it could be the DAOs and this bridging.
Yeah, I think to me it's really like, you know, there's the interesting question that are emerging, especially today, which is how do we regulate this technology? And I think this is challenging because how do we regulate them in a way that does not actually impinge upon the technological guarantees? I think that's a very big challenge. And the other side is more about, it's not about necessarily regulation of the technology, but it's like regulation by the technology. And it's like, how do we embed those technological guarantees in order to actually make regulation obsolete? Because the reason why the regulation existed was because those technological guarantees did not exist, right? So for me, like, those two fields still very open, and there is a lot of important innovation that needs to be done in order to do it correctly.
And I think we are a collection of habits, and those compound over time and lead to certain outcomes. And when I look at someone like yourself, you've obviously had a fascinating career. Are there one or two habits that come to mind that you've intentionally cultivated, or things you do regularly that have helped you in your career?
I think I have, like, I don't know if it's a habit. I think it's more of a modus operandi, which is I have a tendency to be like a procrastinator, meaning like I just, as soon as I need to do something, I just do it immediately. I think that's, it's like, you know, like I get too stressed when I know that I have a lot of things on my plate, so I just do them immediately. The challenge is that no matter what you do, you always have things on your plate. As a procrastinator, you just have to constantly do stuff because you always, as soon as you remove things on your plate, you have a new things on your plate. But I think I'm also very lucky that I absolutely love every moment of my work. I think that's actually the real secret. Is, you know, it's really easy when you, like, when you have the privilege of working on something that you love. Yeah, there is no procrastination possible, because it's actually enjoyable to do the work.
Yeah. And I think doing what you love is so instrumental, and working quickly as well too is really important as well. Thank you for taking the time again. Really enjoyed this conversation.
Excellent. Thanks a lot.